wondering what it looked like there in the dark with these two. That's a pretty strange image.
It's like a Japanese animated story.
Yeah.
You know
what it is? Lying in the light.
The enlightenment part.
Yeah, that was funny. This is the emperor. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavahitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So we have some. This is good. Okay. Radha, you were talking the other day about knowledge of the self not being enough. Ah, okay. We need to understand Ishwara also, that Ishwara is me. Yet those who seem to have only the discrimination of the self through meditation, for example, seem to have a very deep peace and contentment. Can you please talk more about the difference when you know Ishwara or not? Thank you. So let me expand a little bit my own wording that you're quoting here, so I want to make the wording itself a little bit more clear. Like if I say, you were talking the other day about knowledge of the self is not being enough. In fact, knowledge of the self is enough if you recognize that the self is Ishwara. What I was talking about there is if by the Drikdrisha Viveka, the seer-seeing discrimination, which is one of the teaching methodologies, it's a pramana, to take you step by step by step to recognize that innermost self, which is so beautiful. Your being, the nature of your being, is everything that in fact you would want to be. And from the standpoint of the mind, it's a sanctuary. So that recognition, even in the Sankhya Yoga, where the recognition through the Ashtanga Yoga methodologies take you to the experience of samadhi of the Purusha. And the Purusha in the Sankhya Yoga is just pure conscious being. It's exactly really the same as the Atma. It's just being pure conscious being. And in the Sankhya, that recognition is liberation. And they look at the Prakriti, this world as something distinct and different and other than in terms of its very existence. So what I'm saying in the Sankhya, it really has to do with bringing this Prakriti, this world, to a state of absolute samatvam or absolute absorption or equipoise, so that the Purusha can just abide as its non-dual self without the recognition of anything else. And so sometimes, sometimes in the West, we have that idea of liberation or moksha to be just simply the recognition of myself as pure conscious being. And that recognition or that abiding in that non-dual self without the experience of the creation is liberation. So this is from the Vedantic perspective. Within the Vedantic perspective, that idea would be notional. That would not be the vision of Vedanta. Because in the vision of Vedanta, and in what the Prakriyas, the different teaching methodologies, go further. They go further than this, just the seer-seen differentiation, where you're recognizing that your being is something which is free and distinct and differentiated from the body, mind, sense organs in the world, for that matter. And so that, but in, for us, as that prakriya, that's only the first step. Because then what do you do with this creation? What do you do with this body, mind, sense organs, you know, which has been totally differentiated from this non-dual conscious being that is me? What do I do with that? What happens when I come out of samadhi, you know, and now I have this body, mind, sense organs and this world, and what am I supposed to do with it, you know? So what is the relationship of this, of myself, to this body, mind, sense organs? And what is the relationship of this body, mind, sense organs, this just transmigrating jiva? What is the relationship of this body, mind, sense organs to Ishvara, to the universe? Right? So the teaching there, if we stop at just this self-recognition as just the conscious being, without recognizing that this whole creation, in fact, is nothing but that conscious being. Like the clay pot is nothing but the clay. I have to recognize that this whole creation has me for itself, for its truth. That is the vision of Vedanta. And in that recognition that this entire infinite creation is Brahman, is my very self, is myself in terms of the Adhishtana as the conscious being, which supports this infinite imagination, if I could say, you know, not, it's not my personal imagination, it's Ishvara's projection or Ishvara's manifestation of infinite knowledge, we can say. That's what I need to understand, and that Brahman, which is really the truth of the whole thing, like the clay is the truth of the clay pot, Brahman, which is my being, myself, is what is actually here. And these nama rupas, all these names and forms that are in the form of this creation, have no other content at all. Just like the pot has no other content at all than the clay. Now, this universe is only myself. But when we're looking at this universe, and I'm this body, mind, sense organs is walking through it, I have to recognize this. When the manifestation is up, this we call Ishvara, God, Ishvara, the Lord. That this Ishvara is really, has for its Adhishtana, for its being, my own self. And so, in fact, there is nothing other than Ishvara. Myself is Ishvara. This self is the self of Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishvara. There is one self. There is one creation. There is one Ishvara. Then the understanding, well, what is Ishvara real or is Brahman real? Mm-hmm. When we say Ishvara is only Brahman, right? Is the pot real or is the clay real? Well, the pot is only the clay. So is the pot real or the clay real? There's no pot other than the clay. And so that pot is what we call mithya. It's not that it's not there to be experienced, but it is nothing but clay. So like that Ishvara, this entire infinite creation, is certainly here to be experienced. But in terms of what it actually is, it's nothing but the Satchit-Atma. Or this Satchit-Atma is nothing but Brahman, this is the very self which is Ishvara, you know. That is the vision. So now if we look at this wording again, it says, You were talking the other day that knowledge of the self not being enough. I would say like this, thinking that your recognition or knowledge of the self, that the self, the non-dual Atma, my own self experience of myself differentiated from the body, mind, sense organs, that knowledge is enough. That knowledge is not enough. This self needs to be recognized as the self in all beings, as the self of Ishvara, as the Satchit, the conscious being that is the Adhishtana, the very being that the entire creation enjoys. That's Jnanam. Because if you don't have that, then there's this self that your mind can resolve into and have a samadhi experience of, but once you come out, here we are in the world. You know, and actually, the fact is that you never really come out. when you know there's no place where you are not, because you can differentiate in even through with your sense organs. Say your sense organs, that's worse, as you start to really recognize yourself, and then recognize yourself in reference to the nama rupas that you experience. Every name and form that you experience has for its being, or I like to say adhishtana, is totally dependent on the Satchitatma, yourself. And you cannot have an experience that does not have that adhishtana of your own changeless being. And so you recognize yourself in every experience, not as something that you look at with your eyes or hear with your ears, because these sense organs are only good for the sense objects within duality. But all of the experiences have you and your own presence as their being, and there is no experience that's away from that. And so therefore you recognize that you are the, let me say it, put it like this. Until we really gain knowledge, this me is so stuck in the body. But actually it's not stuck in the body at all. It's never been stuck in the body. It's that every vritti that you have has me, my own self, as its being. So you are not embodied. Yourself is not embodied. We're only used to thinking of ourselves as a little pea in the pod, you know, existing kind of a little in here somewhere. Little Atma is in here. No. That's not your experience. You just haven't noticed what your experience actually is. Your experience is not an embodied experience. The self is not embodied. It's not non-embodied. It's not embodied. This dichotomy doesn't even apply. There is nothing that is away from you. So we'll do, these are all prakriyas. We have to get in depth to each one of these prakriyas until we've gone around it so many times that your mind is going to done with it. We have to do that with each and every prakriya, which we'll do. We've got 3 months to do it. That's a great thing. So the knowledge of the self not being enough, we need to understand Ishvara also. That Ishvara is me. Now, that this Ishvara has for its adhishtana the conscious being, which is the conscious being that I am. So in fact, this innermost being is the very self of Ishvara. So maybe it helps to say Ishvara, the self of Ishvara, is myself. Because the identity with this little jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, is so much. How can you say, isn't that kind of rude or disrespectful, to say that this little self is Ishvara's self? But this little self is not little. This body, mind, sense organs is little, not this little self. The self is only one non-dual being. That's the recognition. And that this one me, this one self that I label in English as me, you know, is the very self that is Ishvara, is the very self that is you. And it's all beings. There's not two selves. They're not twins or anything like that. There's only one self, you know. And that self is myself. So the self, which is the self of Ishvara, is the self of all beings. Just like in an imagination, the self of the whole imagination is the self, the one self of the whole imagination is the self of every part of it. Right? Now you say, yet those who seem to have only discrimination of the self through meditation, by example, seem to have a very deep peace and contentment. That's true. That can be true. I would say that can be true only if either they're meditating all the time or if they live a very dharmic life. If your life is committed to dharma, the mind has a deep shanti. And so whether you're meditating or not, there's a very deep, profound peace in the mind. It's a relative peace because it depends upon your actions, you know. But as long as one is committed to dharma, there's a long-standing peace, not just the, what I call, you know, the 15-second samadhi that you get from sensory gratification. It's a natural peace born of your, the harmony of your life with Ishwara. Ishwara is Dharma. If you think of Ishwara as Dharma, then it becomes easier to understand. To the degree that your life is in harmony with the Dharma that is Ishwara, you blend in to Ishwara and there's no agitation or strife or hurt in the mind. Other than for us in this Kali Yuga, the unconscious things that we picked up. But the Dharma brings about a great deal of shanti. And so I was talking about the other night, there are saints, you know, people who are very, very, very saintly, very loving, very kind. You love to be around them because they have a deep shanti in them, their mind that is brought about by, really, by Dharma. And then that shanti can also be deepened by meditation. Yeah. But to say that they're living kind of a wild adharmic life and they have deep peace and shanti, I don't think so. Even meditation's hard to bypass. It's hard to bypass that except for a short period of time. So Dharma and meditation is a nice, good combination. I love the Dalai Lama. There's certain things about what things he said and the way he is in certain ways. You know, even he's a Buddhist, and Buddhism requires an ongoing practice. I can talk about that at some point. But he meditates to this day. He meditates 4 hours a day. You know, and he is a Dharmanishtha. It's the most important thing in his life. He meditates 4 hours a day. One of Swamiji's sannyasins, it was Swami Subodhananda. He passed away a few years ago, 10, 15 years ago, actually. He meditated and he gained this knowledge, but he wanted to own it up. He really did have this knowledge. He had a lot of clarity. But he also had his mind doing this and that and the other thing. And he wanted just to really own this knowledge up. He built for himself a little kutir, a little meditative hut, right near Swamiji's ashram in Rishikesh, not far from it. At that time, there was big fields around his ashram. So he built this little kutir, and these meditative kutirs, you'll see them, I don't know, today, now it's different because it's all, this town has overgrown the ashram, but it used to be, you would see them scattered about. They're just big enough for you to meditate in, to lie down, so you can sleep in it, or you can sit up and meditate. So they're just for meditation. And so this Swami, he, for 8 years, he had, all he did was meditate, have his meals, meditate and sleep, and take care of whatever bodily needs are there, and meditate. For 8 years he did that, you know. And certainly got rid of all of that. Whatever obstructions are there, because he was meditating with knowledge, you know? And that was his sankalpa. That's what most of us probably wouldn't go and meditate for 8 years, but he did that, you know? He did that, and so he had a tremendous absorption of mind. His eyes were just shining with tejas, you know. So nothing wrong with meditation. You have to know what you're doing, though. You know, like, what are you meditating on? What are you meditating for? What are you doing? You know, like, are you meditating blindly? And you meditate and hope Bhagavan blesses me. You know, so it's important that you understand what meditation is in relationship to the particular discipline that you're following. But in Vedanta, it's nididhyasana. It needs to be understood. And it's a beautiful discipline, and that discipline is meant to bring about that day, to break through the dehatma buddhi, commitment, really, that conviction that the self is the body. That's the strongest conviction we have, really. It's never not been there. You're always embodied, and you always take your body to be yourself. It's a very, very strong conviction. So people spend a lot of time working on that if they do. So you can have deep shanti and deep peace if you're a dharmanishta and if you practice certain disciplines like meditation and all of that. It's still relative. The only thing that's not relative is what is not relative. What is not relative is what is free from time. And there's only one thing that's free from time, and that's your being. That needs to be known. Because that self, no matter dharma or dharma, whatever is going on, never touches yourself. And the mind, and we're living within this body, mind, sense organs, is living within this duality. A dharma is very painful. It's certainly not worth it. Especially if you have knowledge, it just doesn't go there. And that's your own recognition. You just don't go there, even if there's some desire coming up. If a desire that's not a non-binding desire comes up, you don't want to go there. It's nothing but trouble. You know, in some of these prakarana granthas that we do, the sadhus or the swamis will say, this is nothing but trouble. Stay away from it. Stay away from it. It doesn't have a good ending. Let's say, no seeking of something for pleasure, for your happiness, so that I can be happy. It won't have a good ending. The happiness is not out there, that's why. And you're hooking your hopes on something that's never had it in the first place. You're going in the opposite direction, it won't have a good ending. So they say it with a lot of firmness. So it says, can you please talk more about the difference when you know Ishwara or not? Yeah, the recognition of Ishwara in terms of your day-to-day life has more than anything to do with it. Of course, the teaching is going to reveal and make you understand Ishwara and appreciate Ishwara. But for your life to be an expression of that recognition requires the assimilation of knowledge in terms of your raga dvesha. As your knowledge roots itself and becomes clear, you know, and there becomes clear, then there's a natural nishtha, a natural conviction there. And the raga dveshas, or your devotion to your raga dveshas, where they're binding desires, as those drop off, the Ishwaratvam, the nature of this creation being Ishwara, becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. Because it is really the raga dveshas, as they pop up, that brings in the jiva. A raga dvesha differentiates everything, because you become a person who wants this object so you can be happy. So the whole world just kind of divides up, and you are a jiva in this world searching for happiness. Even though you know it's mitya and not true, still these habitual ways of behaving will just rise up. At some point you'll say, oh no, there it is. And you go back. You don't want to go there. You don't want to go there because you realize what it is, you know. It's just some samskara, something from the past is rising up in you. Don't fall for it at some point. But when you do fall for it, then even though you have some knowledge, but your mind hasn't had enough time really to deeply assimilate throughout your whole unconscious and throughout all of the samskaras and things you have inside, it hasn't totally assimilated all that. That happens over several years, over many years. But it's a beautiful process. It's like the unfolding of a flower. As all of these inner, we call raga dveshas on a subtle level, as they rise up in your knowledge, and then they fall off, and they fall off, and they fall off. And then there comes a time where, if they're there, you don't mind, but you have no interest in following them. It's just so not worth it. When your mind already knows where that ananda is. So that maturity takes place in time. And as that maturity takes place, there is nothing other than what is that is capturing your mind. So it's Ishvara. It's not something in Ishvara that you want to be happy. It's just a love for Ishvara, the expression of this creation. So what's interesting about that is you can even have that experience as an Ajnani. And you probably can remember even times when you've had that experience, like when you're, I remember especially times, like if as I was walking through nature, for instance, and the beauty of it, the silence, the depth of it. I remember once when I was in India, and I was just starting to learn from Swamiji, and at that time, his kutir was right on the Ganga, and you could walk up beyond the kutir more north. You could walk for miles, you know, until you got into just this profound silence in that very holy land where for thousands and thousands and thousands of years the sannyasis, the sadhus have lived there. There's been so many prayers, so many pujas, so much meditation, and you walk into that very silent, silent, sacred space that is more silent, more subtle than your mind. And your mind just fills the space. You know, you don't have knowledge. I didn't have knowledge at that time. Just the tremendous silence and the tremendous beauty. Ishvara was just kind of manifest there experientially, not because I really knew, because I was only starting out. Just imagine, you know, other times when you've been like sitting at the seashore or taking a walk in the beautiful nature, your mind just gets absorbed in the beauty. And so you don't want anything in particular. There Swamiji will say, until the mosquitoes come. But by that moment, you recognize that something very sacred. Swamiji used to always spoil everything. Okay. In Sweden, we have this method of getting children to fall asleep called the 5-minute method. This means, I should use that myself. Yeah. This means having the child in the bed alone, even if the child is crying, and only go in to the child every 5 minutes. Soothe it, and then go back out again. Then the idea is to continue like this every 5 minutes until the child goes to sleep. It started... I can't remember, 1970 to 80s or something. I thought about this when you talked about the experiments done on small children and mothers. Many children get exposed to this now in Sweden. And maybe also some of us have been exposed as children. How do you think it will affect them? Can you please talk a little about your view on this? Thank you. Well, I'm not sure, but the one thing that comes to me is in the example I used with a little baby working and working for the mother's attention. I think for a little baby, I don't know how long 5 minutes is for a baby. You know, how long is 5 minutes? But this was done for quite a period of time. And it was so harmful to the baby that it totally decompensated, you know. So it would depend on where did they come up with this idea of 5 minutes. What amount of time is tolerable for a child that is missing their parent? What is the tolerable amount of time that them, as you come in 5 minutes, they're still fine? You know, they haven't decompensated at all. They're still whining and crying and whatnot. But in 5 minutes, you're there. So is 5 minutes too long or not? That's the question. In my era, when I was a baby, there was this Dr. Spock. Have you ever heard of him? He said, and unfortunately, my poor mother, who wanted to be the best mother in the world, followed this. If the baby cries, you don't pick them up. That's not 5 minutes. You don't pick them up. You just let them cry. You know? Fortunately for me, my grandfather couldn't stand it. So he would go and rescue me. So that would be, I don't know what kind of studies they've done to see, you know, why 5 minutes? What does that mean? And what is the 5 minute experience for the child? Somehow this works, but I don't know if it's a torture for the child, if it's something that wounds the child for their lifetime, you know, or if 5 minutes is a reasonable, non-harmful period of time and gets the child kind of used to being by themselves or something. I would think I'd probably find it very difficult to do. My little baby was screaming its little head off in the crib, and I have my watch. Okay. I don't think I would be able to do it, but who knows? I don't know enough about it, the science of it. I also don't always trust science. I don't trust old Dr. Spock. He really screwed up a lot of children. Big time, you know. I think you should use your mother's instinct. I guess that's what I feel about myself. If I had a child, I would do what I was called to do, what felt right for me. If it felt right for me, then I would trust myself, I think. At least at this point in maturity, when I was 20 years old, I think I still would. Yeah, I have babies. That's the best I can do with that one. But I've never heard of it before. When I was growing up, people had this thing for not... Is that fulfilling their promises? For not fulfilling their promises? When I was growing up, people had this thing for not fulfilling their promises. What to do? Is what happens is that I don't trust people. They say they will change, but oh, well, that's a different thing. They say they will they say they will change, but no change is there. Is there some way to keep the trust even though others keep this behavior? It makes me so sad. Well, you know, say if in a relationship, the husband or the partner, it's usually because it's not always the man, but it usually is. It could be the woman also, is abusive, and so actually will beat their partner, become just enraged, and then beat or hit their partner physically and harm their partner, and they get so angry and storm out. And then when they calm down, they feel so much remorse. And then they come back and they say, you know, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And now they're all calm and they feel okay inside. And when they say this, please, you know, please forgive me. Give me another chance. I'll never do this again. Okay. They're not lying. They really mean it. Give me another chance. I'll never do this again. I promise I won't do it again. But they are speaking from that part of themselves that is not wounded. And then what happens is something happens. You do something or somebody does something, and this kind of this very violent part of themselves rises up. And this one that had all good intentions is gone. It's just knocked off, right? And then they go on behaving in exactly the same way. And this cycle repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. So even if the wife says, you've said this to me before, you've told me before that you would never do it again, and yet you always do it again. I know, but this time I'm sure that I will never do it again. They're not lying. But there's a split inside, you know. And so, of course, they do it again, and this thing goes on and on and on and on. And so you would, one way of saying, I can never trust this person or people say they're going to do one thing and then they don't do it, you know. Even though, you know, and you've given them this chance and this chance and this chance, and now you just don't trust them anymore, or anyone else perhaps for that matter. But that also is understandable. That feeling is understandable. But once you become, say if you get help and you talk to a psychologist who has some specialization in this type of a syndrome, then you can realize that it's not that this person is lying to you and you can't trust him because he's such a liar, you know. That's not quite what it is. It's that this person has a split inside, and even though this one side has this very serious intention, this other side that really comes up from the unconscious and from their own abuse, probably almost invariably they themselves have been highly abused as a child. Invariably, this side comes up and it knocks off this good intentioned part, you know. So the truth is that you cannot trust this syndrome. So that when your partner is saying this with such sincerity, you can maybe know he means it, but that he won't be able to hold on to that promise when this rises up again. And just the cycle goes on and on and on until they get help. And in fact, that person, the partner, really has to go into do quite a bit of intensive therapy, you know, before you might be willing, once you understand, to try the relationship again. You would have to do a lot of therapy, and you would also have to have a lot of understanding of what's going on. So sometimes these syndromes, these illnesses, you know, cause us to not trust anyone. But it should be that we understand that syndrome and we know we cannot trust whatever the person says when they're calm, because this other person will knock that one away, which is different than thinking everybody's a liar. I hope that makes some sense. They're not lying. It's just only one part of them, when there's a deep split inside, is talking. They themselves think they can really be okay, but they aren't okay, and they will just repeat it again.
How would the person who's being abused handle? What's the best way to handle that?
It's the best way, I think, is to handle it. And there's probably different ways, but is to get help through psychological help, and have your partner has to go into therapy if you're going to stay together. You know. But if he's too bad off, then he becomes life-threatening to you because of his anger. And then you usually have to escape into a woman's shelter or something and then hide away. It's not a happy situation. But if you can insist on therapy for both of you and him going into anger management, you insist on that when he's well. At those times when he's sane, and he may be agreeable to doing that, it's probably better if you can separate for a while and then have both of you be in that process for some time. The problem just depends on how bad it is, because the person can be life-threatening also, and then you have to escape with your children, because when they get into the negative side, you know, you don't know what they can do. And so there, in the States, we have so many shelters. I think in India also, there's a lot of problems around this beating, wife beating. And so you have to escape. It's a very dangerous situation. And people don't escape because they're so afraid that he'll kill them and the children. It's a really very tricky, very horrible situation. You try to get restraining orders and that, you know. It's almost, you have to go into, what is that when somebody who, in the criminal world, they expose another criminal, then they have to be taken away and given a false identity and all of that, but in protective custody, so that that person has no chance of finding them. Oh, these are just terrible horror stories, you know. I would think, like, the instant when a person starts exhibiting this type of behavior, that's the time to either get help or end it before it's become too enmeshed, because you still may have a chance to get out of the situation. You have to move right away, even if you have a hint of it. Say a man loses his temper and hits you, and that's all, I'm sorry. It's not good enough. He's done it. And so you have to nip it in the bud and say, I understand that you're sorry, but we can't stay in together. We can't stay together. And if you can't say that we can't stay together, you have to say, either we go into some therapy and you go into anger management, or we have to separate. It's tricky. I would get help in even making any of these kind of decisions. You know, it's too easy to blame the other person and just say that they're just a liar. It's much more serious than that. All these people are just lying. If that was the problem, then they'd still have some control. They're just a liar, but they have some control. But usually it's not that. It's that part of them really means what they say. And then the other part rises up and causes havoc. It's horrible. It's a very tough situation. You need... There's help for it in most societies. There's a lot of help for it. I would just seek that help immediately. And they're very experienced. So... that's it. Radha said, aim for Seva was Bhagavan's desire. Which one is that then? Anyecha. That's a nice question. This aim for Seva, you know, it was the last, Swamiji had, he really truly felt he was going to Rishikesh to just be with himself and let the students come there, which of course they would, you know, and just live a simple life there. That's it for him. And so the anyecha part was the other people, some of his devotees, had this idea and approached him and asked him if he would do it. So that's the anyecha. That somebody else started with somebody else's desire. They approached him and asked him. What surprised him so much was that he said yes and became interested in it. It shocked him. So that was his response. That was Bhagavan's response. What he felt like, he felt his life was over. And it would just be like kind of retirement, the last part of your life, and just live a quiet life. And he could never live a quiet life because he had so many students, but still he could live a simple life and just stay there in Rishikesh. But then, you know, he said this was like another life hooked on to his life. It felt like another life. Because he kept on teaching anyway. He kept on teaching and teaching these courses until he left. But this aim for Seva was a huge undertaking, you know. And he was totally committed to it. He just found himself really behind it and doing it. But he said it was like he was given another life after this one. That was his experience. So I guess you'd say anyecha. And then probably the one coming up saying yes was Bhagavan. I don't know. We were all surprised that, because it was so, he used to talk about swamis just now and then, about these swamis who become politicians and get so involved in politics and all that. It's not sannyasa. Sannyasa is teaching, you know. It's teaching and contemplation and satsang. That's what a sannyasi does. All of this, rest of it is all samsara. But then he was tapped into the seeming samsara. But when you analyze it, really, or think about it, in terms of what he was destined to do, was to reestablish the pramana, the teaching of the Upanishads in India, and the world, in fact. And he did that with so many highly trained sannyasis, people. You know, but then Bhagawan, if you can imagine Bhagawan thinking, well, but you know, we do need this pramana to be supported. The culture needs to be strengthened so that there's a place for this to exist. And so the aim for Seva was really about strengthening the culture so it could survive all of the immigration from, you know, the Christians and especially the Muslims. And why I say these two is because in the world, as far as we know, these two are the only converting religions, you know, that feel that if you're not a Christian, you won't be saved. This is slowly changing, the reframing the whole Christianity, but what at its core was, for to be saved, you need to become a Christian. That means if you're not a Christian, my duty is to convert you so that you will be saved. And for the Muslims, whether it's just a certain sect of Islam or something that has just been radicalized, you know, everyone needs to be a Muslim. And that's their mission. Of course, it's not that different from Christianity, but they're different religions. They're both part of the, you know, the biblical. All of them are based in the biblical traditions. But, of course, a modern day, more modern Muslim, more modern, if you're Jewish, more modern Jew, or more modern Christian, they've reframed a lot of things. But underlying, there is this conversion aspect. And Swamiji will say that aspect of conversion, that belief in conversion, is violence. He has it. He had a little booklet. His little booklet is titled "Conversion is Violence," and it is an assault on the other person's culture and their belief system, the entire culture, really. And if you strip the person's culture away from them, they're left in shards, really, you know. So he felt it was a great violence. Tattva bodha, knowledge of the truth. It seems, using a pronoun, that can mean anything. Yeah. To represent the word truth could make it easy to misunderstand, especially in sentences like tattvam. Oh, that's very good. Let me explain that. The sentence is like tat twam asi. Please explain. Okay, so now if I say tat twam, that twam affix is actually an affix that creates a word, tat twam. Tat twam means the ness of the pronoun, right? Whatever the pronoun is. Now, the thing is, a pronoun actually is a pronoun because it can stand for anything in the creation. Like if you say that or this or it, it can land on absolutely anything in the creation. So whatever is in the creation that can, and whatever is in the creation can take this pronoun, that or this or it, or anything, you know. And so the reality, the ness of that, the being of that, is the truth. So the tattva is that which is the very being, the essence, you know, the ness of that. And that can stand from anything within the universe. Any nama rupa within the universe can take a pronoun, and the whole universe can take that pronoun. And so the being of that is the tattva. Whereas in tat, tvam, asi, we have three words, three real separate words, where tat means that, as in the tattva. Tat means that, tvam means you, and asi means are. So tvam, asi, you are, tat, that. So that you are, tat, tvam, asi. Where tattva or tattvam is in the neuter, that M is from the neuter of tattva, it means the ness or the being of that. So one is just an affix that is added to a pronoun to make another word. And in the other case, tattvamasi, there are two separate pronouns, that and you. You are that. Means you, O jiva, you know, you are Ishvara. Or you, O wave, you are the ocean. Tattvamasi. See the difference? It is important for this tattva that tat can mean anything. That's the point. That no matter what it is, the truth of that. So the tattva is that which is the truth of everything, is the tattva. Okay. So tattva bodhaha, knowledge of the truth of everything. That which is the reality, the ultimate reality, because it is the ultimate reality of everything that is. Is that so? Tattva bodha, knowledge of the tattva. That makes sense. So tvam can mean you, or tva can mean the abstract of a noun, the ness of the noun, and putting that im on it puts it, makes it a neuter noun. Okay. We have a few more minutes. Oh, this is a good question. I'm not sure I can answer it, really. Maybe. When is something a religion and when not? What is really the different the definition? Mm-hmm. What Swamiji will say about this, and I also think when I was in the university, I studied some interreligious dialogue and things like that. You know, and also Houston Smith, who's kind of an interesting religious scholar, he passed away some years ago. He talked about this, and he actually, I like what he had to say. He, in a book by Fritjof Schuon, I think he's a German theologian, Fritjof Schuon, he wrote a book called The Transcendental Unity of Religion. That was the name of the book. And Houston Smith wrote the introduction to this book. And he was a very broad-minded religious scholar. And he had tremendous respect and kind of love for all the religions, especially India, especially Hinduism. And so what he did was he wrote the introduction to this transcendental unity of religion. So he had a drawing, and the drawing was a triangle that went like this. Here's the triangle. And at the bottom of the triangle, he had all of the different religions like Christianity and Islam and Buddhism, and he had maybe Judaism, and he had maybe six, seven, eight different religions listed in the bottom. And at the top of the triangle, at the very top here, he had the mystical traditions of those religions. And then he had lines going up to the top. And so at the bottom, there was so much dogma, different beliefs and different rituals, different ways of worship, you know, and different images, you know, like Muhammad is different than Christ, is different than Moses, is different than the Buddha. The way they worship is different. The languages they use, the style of the worship, where heaven and hell and all of these kinds of things, their dogmas are different down at the bottom here, right? But at the top of the pyramid is the mystical traditions of each one of those religions. And those mystical traditions have so much in common. Where, because a mystic, what we call a mystic in kind of an academic word in a way, but what is meant by a mystic is that a mystic, it's the dogma and the worship and the pujas is not enough. It's not that there's anything wrong with it, but they want the direct, immediate relationship, knowledge, unity, identity from our perspective with God. They want to know God. They want a real relationship with God, with the divine. And so it's not, they're not satisfied, a mystic is not satisfied with just a worship, you know. Doing prayers, doing chants, doing rituals to the God, to the God of your religion, which you believe exists. You have Shraddha, and you do these rituals and prayers and all of that, and pray to that God for blessings and all of that. And that level, so on that level, for a mystic, it's not enough. Even if they were to do all of those things, just because of being a part of that religion, they may do all of those things. But what they need and long for is for the divine to know the divine, whatever that is in their religion, to have a unity, to unite with that. For us, it's the identity. So there's so much in common with the mystics. And so when I think of a difference between religious expression or religion and spirituality, spirituality, I believe, though other people, it's not like there's one definition, but spirituality has more to do with the relationship, the personal relationship with the divine, whatever that is for you. There's a personal relationship, it's closer to mysticism, you know. And so you can say that you're a spiritual person because there is something greater than yourself that is very of your ultimate concern, which holds you. Whereas in the religious level, there are beliefs, prayers, structure, you know, all of those things. And in Hinduism, we have all of that too. And I love all of that. But I think I would be very bereft if that's all that I had, because I would do that all for Antakarna Shuddhi and for love, you know. But I would have to know. I want to know God. I think the spiritual people are not so engaged with the dogma or with the ritual expression as they are with the relationship with the divine. That's one way I would answer it, but I think that you could probably look it up or Google it and say, how do people talk about the difference between religion and spirituality? I think it's quite a question. So it'd be interesting also for you to look into yourself and see. So anyway, but I'm using this Houston Smith article, and I always have liked his little drawing. You know, I passed it out at NCIS where I work. There, I've passed that out to my students on many occasions, you know, when I'm teaching the like Eastern theories of self-mind and nature, and I compare it to the West, the Western kind of containing myth versus what holds the East. I often show them this and talk about it because it's more easy to to accept the differences and realize that there's something underneath. Yeah. Two minutes, just enough time for a bhajan.
Malika,
you have harmonium? Let's do it. That'd be great. That'd be beautiful. Oh, we have got one. Oh, we've got a couple more. We'll do it tomorrow. We'll keep these in here, and these will be with the ones that we did that I'll put here. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What do you need? Okay.
Thank you.
Can we do another one?
Which one?
Remember
the A major root, so it's just A minor up to C. Thank you.
swasti
prajāpyah paripālayantam nyāyena margena mahim mahiṣāḥ ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam lokā samastā sukhino bhavantu kāle varṣatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini tesho yamsho barahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukha bhavet asato ma satkamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate om shanti shanti shantihi harihi om shri gurubhyo namaha harihi om